For Sunday, the 31st of December, 2017, I'm Brian Truda. This is Casey Close Up. Thank you so much for being here. Well, this is it, our final show of the year. We've talked to some amazing people in the past 52 weeks. We've heard some amazing stories. We have gone to some amazing events. Kansas City really is such a giving town, has a lot of people who care, and really has had that renaissance that people talk about when it comes to the arts, culture, technology, banking and finance, technology and infrastructure, really wanting to move ahead and make ourselves a better place. 2018 is going to be quite the year. But first, for today, we look back on some of our favorite stories and favorite interviews of 2017. Enjoy. We are joined today by a few very special guests in studio. The first one is a best-selling author and one of the respected specialists in childhood neurological disorders in America. He is Dr. Robert Melillo, and he is joining us here in studio this morning as one of the founders also of Brain Balance Achievement Centers. Dr. Melillo, welcome to Casey Close Up.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
So as we're going to talk about here in just a little bit, Brain Balance is now open in Lee Summit. And we're going to talk to the owners of Brain Balance Lee Summit here in a second. This is their big ribbon-cutting weekend, and that's why we're pleased to have you in town this weekend as well. You've given some lectures this weekend, too. We'll talk about the new center here in Kansas City, and we'll talk a little bit more about the program as we go along. But you have a book out called Disconnected Kids, and it talks about why the Brain Balance program is needed and why it works. And why don't we start there at that point, and you can give us a little overview about the book and about Brain Balance Achievement Centers.
Sure. You know, the main reason for all of this really is that we are facing an epidemic, a childhood epidemic of really almost epic proportions. I mean, we're seeing the rises of numbers of kids with attention problems, behavioral mm-hmm. issues, social issues, learning challenges, learning disabilities, kids with labels like things like ADHD, you know, autism, dyslexia, or just have exploded. I mean, I don't know if people are aware of some of the numbers, but like autism in the United States 30 years ago was diagnosed 1 in 10,000. It's now 1 in 67 or 1 in 42 boys. ADHD wow. is the number one mental disorder amongst the youth. It affects 1 out of every 9 kids. And basically we're looking at 1 in 4, 1 in 5 kids or adolescents in the United States have some sort of label. And most experts believe that that's really underreported, meaning that it's more than that. If you look at most school districts across this country, 20-25% of the, you know, student population qualifies for special ed. And so this is a huge crisis. And I believe it's the most important social issue of our time. And it's basically been, for the most part, ignored by a lot of mainstream media because they don't really know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And most people are told that, you know, they just have to accept these issues and that there's not much that can be done. Schools and most other programs are all about just trying to compensate and try to figure out ways to manage these issues on a long term. And there really is no good way to manage these things long term. And so, you know, my research and what my book and what Brain Balance is based on is really, you know, 20 years of brain research looking at what is actually happening in the brain. How does it get that way? And most importantly, how do you correct it? And that's what we're about. We're not about just managing these issues. We're not about just, you know, being a Band-Aid. We're about fixing them. And yep. that's what we do the majority of the time. And we've actually worked with now tens of thousands of families and kids across the United States. So we have a pretty huge sample set on that.
So tell us then, what does Brain Balance do for a kid, for families? How does it work?
Well, as we said, it really all starts with what is the actual problem? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I cover in my lectures when I lectured the other night here. We really want to let people know about that. And so what it is there's a problem called functional connectivity or functional disconnection in the brain. And the good news is that there isn't any injury, there isn't any damage or pathology. It's not a genetic disorder per se from a standpoint of genetic mutation. You know, the idea of chemical imbalances, nobody really looks at that in research so much anymore. Mm-hmm. What we see is that there's a problem with the way that the brain is connecting with itself and the way it ends up integrating, and especially between the two hemispheres. And this usually happens during development, either in the womb or the first few years of life. Yep. And what happens is it causes what we call a developmental asynchrony, which means there's a different maturity rate in different areas and different networks on one side of the brain versus the other. And this disrupts the normal communication and flow. And the reason for this is that one side of the brain or the other is relatively slow or delayed or immature in its growth. Mm-hmm. And the other side of the brain may be actually accelerated or advanced.
Yep.
And this creates this imbalance between the brain and between the hemispheres that we end up seeing in the child, that parents will recognize that the child is struggling in certain areas, but they're really good in other areas. You know, they may be exceptional at Legos, or they have a phenomenal memory for certain things, or they're a little obsessive, or they're compulsive. Areas of the brain may be too strong when they have other areas of the brain that are really delayed and immature, and that is really a signal of this developmental imbalance.
Well, people will very famously say, oh, I'm left-brained, I'm right-brained, but really there's a connection there that you're somewhere in the middle is what talk to each other.
The fact is we are all either right-brain or left-brain dominant, just like mm-hmm. we're left-hand or right-hand. And what we're finding now is that with the advanced ways that we can image the brain in real time, we're finding that whole idea of right brain, left brain is actually more important than we ever believed. Whereas a lot of people thought that, you know, years ago they kind of discounted some of it. Now we're realizing that, no, it actually is very, very important. And the balance of the activity and information and the integration between those hemispheres is really critical. And what we're learning is that an imbalance between them is really at the root of almost all mental health and learning issues. And all of those things really usually initially start developmentally, meaning that, you know, they're something that really start in childhood, even if it doesn't show up until their 20s. But these are things that also can be changed by reconnecting or by connecting the hemispheres of the brain. And, you know, whether we're left hemisphere or right hemisphere is a normal trait from a dominant standpoint. But if that trait becomes too extreme, then it can actually end up as something like autism or ADHD or dyslexia. And that's where a lot of people look at now in the research, is that these are just extremes of normal human traits.
Okay. And so we're talking with Dr. Robert Melillo again. He's the founder of the Brain Balance Achievement Centers. He's written a book called Disconnected Kids. He lectured this week here in Kansas City as we are set to cut the ribbon on one of the new Brain Balance Centers in Lee's Summit. What type of kids will benefit from Brain Balance? And at what point should a parent say, man, you know, this is, I'm feeling this concern. Maybe I should take my child to Brain Balance.
Right. And that's really, you know, the key is that understanding Brain Balance, even though we are technically learning centers, we work with kids that really have more significant learning challenges, right? Yep. We're not just mm-hmm. doing basic tutoring. We're a very comprehensive type of program, because what we're dealing with are kids that really have significant learning challenges. They may have a label, but maybe 50% of the kids that come in our centers don't have any specific label. We just know that they're behind. You know, if they're more than two, a year and a half or two grade levels behind in certain subjects, that's an indication that they may, you know, benefit from what we do, especially if there's this imbalance in their skills,
okay,
where they may be, you know, average or at their age level in certain things, and they may be really behind in others. Or we see kids that may be two, three, four grade levels ahead in certain things, and then they're two or three grade levels behind in others. Mm. The further that imbalance between their strengths and weaknesses, the more of a problem they have. And that's more of an indication that it's something we can help with. But, you know, the kids that we work with, they're healthy. They don't have, we don't work with brain injury. We don't work with genetic disorders per se. We don't work with kids that are sick or, you know, have metabolic issues. We're working with kids that are, for the most part, you know, healthy and, you know, look perfectly normal, but yet are struggling and nobody really knows why. Another indication is many of these kids had something during their development that where they missed or they were delayed in their milestones, where, you know, they didn't crawl on time and they crawled in an unusual way. They walked a little later than they should. And that may have led to them being a little late in talking. And, you know, and the parents may have been told, well, you know, kids develop at different rates and it's not that big of a deal, but it is. And that's the type of thing that parents will see with the kids that we work with. And, you know, these are the kids that we do really, really well with. And most of the time, as I said, we're looking to really fix the problem, because what we see is that these kids are actually usually very gifted. The kids that are more likely to end up with these issues are kids that are really actually talented and gifted in certain areas of their brain, and they're more likely to potentially have an imbalance.
I'm pretty sure that this is a solid look at what the average family in Kansas City goes to. I pick my kid up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon from school. We come home. She is hungry. She is tired from the day. She doesn't want to listen. She doesn't want to do her homework. She just fights every, even down to what we're going to have for dinner becomes a battle that night. And I think that same thing happens in households all across Kansas City. Today, we're going to have a very interesting discussion about the family, about kids, and about behavior. And now that we're back to school, this is a very, very important topic for families all over. Let's say hello to Jenny Bjorum. She is a speech pathologist and owner of Children's Therapy Services from Leawood. Jenny, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, is that a pretty common scenario that happens in people's houses, that they butt heads with the kids over even the smallest of decisions?
Oh, absolutely. I get that comment from families all of the time. You know, why won't my kid listen to me? Why won't my kid follow my directions? Or my kid's bad, which I don't believe. I don't believe kids are bad. You know, it's very common. I see it day in and day out in my therapy practice, when I sit down with coffee with my friends, speaking to my neighbors, and all of us moms get together and, you know, having that frustration with our kids.
Sure. There is a line that people will say, well, part of it is that kids are being kids and that you have to give them a certain, you know, level or latitude, I suppose. But what are some things that can help parents to solve that issue from your perspective?
Sure, absolutely. So I have a list that I usually go through with my families that will kind of help empower them to help their children and them have a more successful interactions, and so that everybody's getting along a little better, the child's listening. And truly what I usually tell my families, it's all about what you do as the parent, what you say as the parent, how you are going to change and not changing the child. So I can start and just kind of go through some of that list and we can kind of talk about what it may look like.
Yeah, that's good, because we hear that all the time, that it's really, you know, you're talking to parents, you're not talking to kids and changing them. And kids will mimic a lot of what they see at home or see the way that they're brought up. It's not necessarily the environment around them, but it's really the parental environment. Is that kind of an accurate statement?
Absolutely. I mean, the kiddos are going to follow your lead, and whether they're doing something bad or good and you pay attention to it, you're reinforcing it. Right. So, you know, when we see our kid do something good, you know, we may say, hey, I really like how you picked up your shoes and put them in the basket. But when you see them throw their shoes on the ground, then, you know, then you're like, don't throw your shoes on the ground. Go put them in the basket. Well, I like that go put them in the basket piece. But when you tell your child don't, they don't hear don't. They hear throw your shoes on the ground. So instead, okay, I always tell parents to tell their children what you want them to do instead of what you don't want them to do.
Okay.
So that's my first big tip. Don't say don't, which is kind of funny. But I've got a great example. So I was out to dinner one night with my family. I have three kids. I have a 15-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 6-year-old. And I think this was probably a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And my middle child, Ryan, she's now 11. I had brought a big bag of little animals. And I passed, she's like, Mom, give me those animals. So I passed them to her and I looked straight at her. I said, don't dump them out. You know what that child did?
First thing they do.
She turned that bag over and dumped them out. And my husband looked at me. He's like, you just disobeyed your own don't say don't rule. And I said, I sure did. And so when I tell that story to my family, and they always ask me, well, what would you have said? What should you have said? Yeah. And what I probably should have said is, hey, choose 5 or 6 animals and take them out, and rather than saying, don't dump them out.
Okay.
And it's the same with, like, a lot of kids will come to my clinic and they'll play with the door, and the parents will say, don't play with the door. And I'll immediately say, close the door.
Right, right. So you're giving them positive parameters while also really burying in there the message of what you want to happen.
Exactly. So they don't have a, you know, so that they really truly don't hear don't. Mm-hmm. They just hear the rest. They don't hear don't. Don't play with the basket. Play with the basket.
Right, right.
You know, don't throw that. Throw that. So just telling them what you want them to do. Put it in. Give it to me. Throw it in the trash, and give them strict directions on exactly what you want them to do, or even a choice. So you could always give them a choice.
Okay.
Yeah.
What else is on the list here for helping out parents in the battle?
Well, I always tell families what you focus on, you get more of. So if your child is throwing a massive fit and you're talking to them and you're looking at them and you're touching them, then you're basically telling them, good job, that's working for you. Keep throwing that fit. Now, mind you, we have to keep in mind if a child's starving or dirty, or, you know, has a dirty diaper or is sick or is extremely tired. But those general meltdowns when there's something that they want that you said no to or they can't have, and then they throw a fit or fall out, or, you know, it's kind of the best to just say, when you're done crying and throwing a fit, then let's talk, and then just kind of walk away. So what you focus on, you get more of, is what I tell families.
We have the infamous no pants scenario in our house.
Oh.
It was a fit when she was about 2 years old where she didn't want to wear pants, which, I mean, hey, I know that battle, but she refused to absolutely wear pants and then threw a huge, humongous fit about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, we'll call you when you're done with this, because I'm not going to sit here and put up with the screaming and the crying and the red face and the throwing stuff around the room and all that jazz.
Yeah. I mean, in that situation, you're right. Just kind of wait till she's calmed down, and then you can have a little discussion about it and give her a choice. Well, it is not a choice to not wear pants. You have to wear pants today, but you can choose the red pants or you can choose the blue pants. What's your choice? And if they don't choose, then you can tell them, you know what? If you don't choose, I will choose for you and help them make that choice. And then, you know, with repetition and consistency between parents and grandparents or nannies or whomever is the helper with that child, then that child will be like, oh, this is how it is. This is how it's going to happen. This is what we'll do.
Right. You know, this may be a sidetrack, but a lot of people then want to jump to, well, you know, you're going to be in timeout or, you know, even worse sorts of disciplinary actions. What do you say to them? That doesn't help anything, right?
Sure. So for me, I don't use timeout. I don't think timeout works. So typically what I will do is when that child does something I don't want them to do. Let's say they throw a toy. So I'm immediately, first of all, going to tell them what I want them to do. Pick it up. And if they don't pick it up, I'll take their little hand and walk them over and have them pick it up and put it in my hand. So they picked it up with my help.
Right.
And then I'll probably keep the toy, but not really say anything more about it. And if they throw the fit because I had to give them the toy, then I'm going to say, when you're done throwing a fit, then you can get up. And I just walk away. Now, at our house, the stairs was kind of always our spot.
Okay.
So if I had a throwing fit child, I would just carry them to the spot and say, here, when you're done throwing a fit, you can get up. And then, you know, you might hear some screaming and kicking. And then a little bit later, they come in, I'm sorry, Mom, or I'm done now, is what I would get a lot.
Right,
but as long as everybody's consistent, and it's not a timeout because there's no time attributed to it. It's, I need my time to throw a fit. It's okay to throw a fit. It's okay to be mad or angry or frustrated. And I like using those words because it helps with that emotional intelligence and works on that emotional regulation. But you know, then when they come back and they're out of that emotional state and more into that rational state, then they can say, I'm sorry for throwing a fit, or I was mad. And or you could come back and say, yeah, I know you're mad and frustrated. I understand. And it's okay to be mad and frustrated, but you may not throw toys. So that was how I would handle that situation. Yeah.
Is that it in general? Should parents give their kids more emotional space or room to be angry, mad, sad about things?
Absolutely. We get mad. We get angry. We get sad as adults. And many times we just don't see much tolerance for it with young children because we get frustrated as adults.
Right. Well, it doesn't always happen on our timeline.
No, it doesn't happen on our timeline. I've got to be at work.
Gotta go.
The bus is coming. I need to get in the car.
Right.
No, it's not on my timeline. It's never on our timeline.
That's true.
So even giving visuals. So in our preschool and in our clinic, we've got a happy face and we've got a sad face and we've got a mad face and we've got maybe a surprised face. But we'll use those to kind of show them, oh, look, especially for very young kids like two-year-olds, you're mad. You're feeling very mad. It's okay to feel mad. When mm-hmm. I'm mad, I make my face and I grasp my fists and, you know, explain to them how I feel mad. And it's okay because we want them to begin to understand these feelings instead of telling them stop crying or no, you can't be mad or, you know, stop that. Because instead, you are going to get so much further with your child if you say, oh, I understand you're frustrated and I understand you're mad, but you may mm-hmm. not throw the toy.
Right. We have worked together over the past 15 years, and this year celebrating 15 years of Head for the Cure, the 5K run walk in Kansas City. Let's say good morning to Matt Anthony. Good morning, Matt.
Hey, Brian. Good morning. Great to be here. 15 years. Wow.
Can you believe it?
They say that that each year time passes at an accelerating pace, and I think that's true. But it's great that we've been able to do this all these years, and I can't thank you personally enough and all your mates and your colleagues at 102 in Steel City for helping us out all these years.
It's always our pleasure, Matt. Let's take a look now at the 15-year mark. When you look back from the top of the 15-year hill, when you look back and see, I mean, first off, did you ever think you would be where you are now?
Well, no. I mean, it is amazing. I think that, you know, thinking back, you know, life is filled with reflection, and so when something in your life happens that's unexpected and, of course, unwanted and tragic, it's you can't really look forward at all until you gather yourself and understand that even with difficulty, there's hope and positivity and joy behind it. And so as I reflect on 15 years, yeah, we had no idea where this thing would go. Now looking back, I'm delighted and proud that we've kept it going and that we have made a difference in raising money and along the way raising hope. And I have my brother Chris to thank for making that so.
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning with that story that goes back now nearly 17 years ago, October of 2000, Chris diagnosed with a brain tumor. What is the thought in the family at the time?
Yeah, you know, it's a couple of things. Chris was my younger brother, healthy athlete, 34 years old, worked for me at VML, a company that we were building back mm-hmm. in 2000, and we had just opened a small Dallas office, and Chris agreeably said, okay, I'll come work for my brother and serve as the... It was really a five-person office opening in Dallas, and Chris became our general manager. So only 6 months later, he was diagnosed with glioblastoma, brain tumor, which tough to pronounce and certainly didn't understand what that meant, only that it was unimaginable because the prognosis was grim. Mm-hmm. He was given a life expectancy of a year at the time, and he well exceeded that and had a pretty extraordinary life by living an ordinary life for those two plus years. But yes, it was like anybody who faces these things, you know, it's devastating, but yet you know that there's something positive that will come from it.
At the time, because you look back on it now, and you look back on it with the knowledge that you have now, you've built yourself up. You're working with hospitals and doctors and, you know, even Michelle Obama, as you mentioned off the air, and doing these different health initiatives. But to look back now and say, man, there was so much that we had to learn, that was kind of the beginning of the whole arc of knowledge there.
That's no question. And you don't know really what you don't know. And and I think also recognizing that, you know, I'm like you, Brian, you know, I'm a communications person, you know, an ad guy. And so, there's some level of intimidation by the science of the medical field. People who are out there every day looking under the microscope to protect the health of people and to advance studies so that people can have full and complete lives. So there was a certain amount of intimidation by that, and so you try to learn what you can, but learn what you can as a layperson so that you can understand it, manage it, cope with it. And I think that was a lesson that certainly Chris helped us all overcome, and that what has carried us forward and Head for the Cure all these years forward.
So the early 2000s, you look at it and you say, well, we want to do something. We want to raise money. We want to find a way to help this. Chris was a runner. And is that where the 5K
it is.
Was born out of?
It was really his idea. We were, Chris was like so many of us, you know, he participated in sports. He tried to stay fit here and there. And during his disease, as living his life with a brain tumor, with brain cancer, he would try to exercise. He would, you know, if he felt up for it, he might run a mile, might run 2 miles. He might run down the block. He might run down the driveway, but it was just a way to, you know, to keep to stay alive, to know that he felt alive, and so toward the end of his life, when we knew that was inevitable, he and I were on a short bike ride, which is something we did too, and he suggested, hey, we should start a run. We should start a run to raise awareness for brain cancer, brain tumors, particularly those malignant brain tumors like glioblastoma, and maybe we'll raise some money. And it was sort of in that order, you know, and it was a very matter of fact. It wasn't a battle cry. It wasn't a let's change the world. It was just a simple statement of, hey, maybe we can help a few people along the way. So that was really the root of it. And then Chris's wife, Kirsten, and the rest of the family said, okay, let's do this. And fortunately, we had VML also, a company that I ran and was running at the time to put some marketing muscle behind it. And that really helped to put a face to Head for the Cure.
Sure. The first one.
Yeah, you were. So it's wild. You know, I was telling this story the other day that, so I might start with where we are now. So over the 15 years, we've had around 120,000 people participate in our events, Kansas City being the signature and represents
incredible.
But we now do this around the country. That first year, we had about 300 people.
That's right.
And we thought we smashed it.
Yes,
you know,
this
was great. We were thrilled. You know, this was awesome. And you guys were out. It was tremendous. It was joyous. It was a celebration. It was in memory, but it was really out of hope for people in the future. And I think that was the discovery. So while Chris said, raise awareness for a disease that's underfunded and thus under-researched, raise funding in a grassroots way, which, you know, the grassroots are the things that matter the most, I believe. And then the third thing that Chris didn't articulate, but we discovered together was that along the way we're raising hope, that has trumped, not a political point, everything in terms of awareness and funding. But man, if you can inspire people and bring hope forward, that galvanizes people, and that's the greatest reward that I think all of us who've been a part of Head for the Cure feel from the organization.
My thanks to all of our guests who joined us in 2017. I really sincerely hope that you and your family had a great holiday season, that you have a great new year, You be safe tonight, of course, and come back and join us in 2018 for bigger and better things as this city and this show continues to grow. Really, the show is built on the backs of people who want to make Kansas City a better place to live and work and play, and that's what we highlight on this show. So looking forward to another great year of KC Close-Up. So happy new year to you, and we will see you next Sunday for another edition of KC Close-Up.